R22, tout le monde. Antenne cadiste.
It seems relatively obvious why words are often inadequate sort of when waged against the power that music, you know, has. It seems that this would be the moment. I have almost nothing to say, but I will talk briefly about the collaboration that led to this this exchange between Mike and Stephanie, which I understand is relatively storied, but I'm going to kind of summarize the very sort of particular narrative of Sensus Plenio and what it meant to work with Stephanie on a project that is currently on view at the Jeux de Paume. And if you've had time to see it and to pass by, or if you get time, I think it closes this weekend, so it's Run, Don't Walk. But I wanted to say that, you know, in the instance of Mike's work, which I came to know through Stephanie, and many things that I came to know through Stephanie, to quote a recent critic writing about the work, to say about his album Father Divine, the MC's grittiest and rawest album to date, can leapfrog between dub, punk, electro and soul, and while being rooted in the language of hip-hop. And then with regards to your extended relationship to the musicians you work with, this critic says that coming from diverse musical backgrounds, the players serve Mike Led's deconstructionist approach to hip-hop perfectly. As they approach every genre and song, they attempt with a seat of the pen's vitality. And I think that there is something, sorry to have butchered that quote, but I think that there's something very particular about the kind of fluency between the currency of, let's say, instrumentation and thinking through the language of music, and obviously what it means to work as an artist, which is often fraught with all sorts of questions around medium and how one can push usually the tools that one is given to the limit, in a sense that you've demonstrated that in music time and time again, and that's where I definitely see a parallel with Stephanie and how I've observed her work. And as far as the work at the Jeux de Paume is concerned, it's a work that, like so much of what Stephanie's produced, has interrogated this question of language. And to summarise briefly, Sensus Plenio, which Stephanie may have alluded to but refers to fuller meaning, is a work in which there is a kind of central theme, let's say, of pantomime, of mime more generally, and it maps out a very kind of complex relationship between mime, gesture, divinity within the gospel context of Harlem, of Susan Webb and the Mime Ministry of Harlem, but does so in very interesting ways with regards to music, and I'm sure that Stephanie will elaborate on. But really, to sort of close the musical specificity of Stephanie's practice, which seems so clear in Sensus Plenio, you'll find that the work is accompanied by a song soundtrack that brings together the work of Maz Swift, a violinist, and Brandon Lopez on upright bass. And in that work, you see that the music is arranged in such a way that it's interpreted through the language of gestures that you encounter in that work. And I'm assuming you've seen it, but, you know, hopefully this will encourage you to do so. The music is interpreted through video sequences, allowing for a unique relationship between, let's say, languages, textures, and the performances within the video that you'll get to observe. But I think, speaking more generally about my thoughts in response to what we all just heard, I thought about three, let's say, prompts that I'd like to place sort of in your peripheral vision, maybe, because I know there's things that you want to deal with directly. But I was thinking about an expanded field of experimental positions taken up by black musicians, which is so kind of seems to be a narrative thread running through the work. Is it, what does it mean to take up a position of, let's say, difference or opacity within relation to an expanded field of modernity that constitutes, say, a musical history or an art history? The radical currents and discords of harmony that then cut through that difference. So I think time and time again, you've got a kind of sense that musicians of all kinds, but particularly those working within experimental fields, are pushing against those traditions in ways that not only confound, let's say, the logic of music, but blur the lines between the medium, which was the earlier idea, and then also that the idea that perhaps black radical musical traditions are as elusive as the culture itself and often completely difficult to pin down, and that one would feel maybe that it was inappropriate to contextualise them alone within in relation to, let's say, classical music, jazz or otherwise, or hip-hop. But it would seem to be more important to think about the kind of, let's say, sonic alphabets that Stephanie's been so interested in with her research on Francois Soude, and the kind of very particular narratives that force open a dialogue between the very meaning of language and music. So those are the kind of currents I wanted to introduce. I should also say, as a kind of... as an extension of this project, Stephanie will give a performance on Saturday evening in Nogent-sur-Marne at MEBA, which you're all welcome to join. And then we have a conference or a one-day symposium at the Jus de Pomme throughout Saturday, which will encompass all four artists who've taken part in this year's satellite program, which I've had the great fortune of curating. And it's been very fascinating. Stephanie is one of the four artists. The other artist, Ali Cherie, we collaborated earlier in the year, actually last year, on a project with Cadist and Ali Cherie, Oscar Murillo and Jumana Mana. So I hope that you will make it on Saturday, if not Saturday evening, to see Stephanie's work. And I'm going to hand it over to Mike and Stephanie to kind of elaborate. And if you want me to step in at any point, but I'm going to leave it up to you guys. So thank you all for being here.
This is only the maybe the second or third time that I've listened to all of this material or a lot of this material together. Some of it is very new. For example, the Microcosmos performance was just 2 days ago, the recording. So, others were just last month or the month before. The saxophone performance we heard before that was in November. So a lot of this I'm still kind of thinking through and processing. There's other material that I've very rarely listened to in the last many years. I'm Singled Out and Separated, for example, which I made in 2008. I've only listened to a few times since that time. Hello, all of you camera holding people. So I hope. So I'm thinking it through out loud to some degree with you, with all of you as well. And I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts about. And responses to the trajectory that was sort of traced today.
Well, how does it feel to hear Singled Out and Separated after a long, something that powerful after such a long time?
It's intense. Yeah, it's really intense.
So it was emotional. Like, I mean, you got choked up.
I was choked up. Yeah, it's emotional.
Because that one really, really hit me.
Yeah. It also, I know that this was a lot of material. I was thinking that there needed to be something for you to do while you were listening, but then I didn't really think about how this. Of course, this is a lot, but buried in here is a little bit of context. The choir that I worked with for that piece is the choir associated with a church that was founded by my grandfather on the south side of Chicago. When he entered the church as pastor, it was a tiny, tiny church. It was actually in a formerly Polish neighborhood. The demographics of the neighborhood had changed around the church, and the church was trying to decide whether to stay and shift its congregation or whether to shut down entirely. And they decided to hire my grandfather to try to rethink what that church and what that space could be within the community. He turned it into an enormous institution, serving thousands of people. It has a K-8 school, a substantial daycare center. It's a huge church. It was a huge church when he retired in 2000. And I spent quite a lot of time in that church growing up. Knew many of the members of the choir, as well as the choir director. I grew up in Cincinnati, but I went back to Chicago for graduate school, and it's while I was there that I collaborated with them to make that piece.
Well, let's start there, because I mean there were other things that I wanted to bring up, in especially in relationship to the questions you proposed. So maybe we'll go back to them. But that, you know, how does one work as a Black experimental artist, Black American experimental artist, in particular? But so just within that and within experimentation, how important is the church? Because we were talking about this morning. I know my personal experiences when I started creating as a Black American artist, I found myself, and growing up with a pretty much atheist mom, a very religious grandmother, I found myself running to the Bible, reluctantly. But I knew I needed that background, and I found myself at a great disadvantage with my peers who did grow up with the Bible or who did grow up with church, because it is so much a part of our discourse and what we reference. I mean, but then, so the question for me is, where does it land specifically for you, right? Because we also talked about there's even different chord progressions. I mean, the difference between Protestant based and Catholic based. Yeah. Catholic based pop is very different than Protestant pop. You know, how do those chord structures, how have you been able to navigate and profit and how, or take advantage of what's your opinion of your experience yep. in church?
No, it's a really good question, especially given that church recurs in thematically in census plenier. I grew up attending Catholic schools, but going to Black Protestant Christian churches on the weekends and spending summers at Vacation Bible School at my grandparents' church. So I had many diverse experiences of church and of church music as a child. And I was always very aware of the distinction between, on the one hand, the role, the kind of social and community role that church fulfills, and the political role that the Black church has fulfilled in the U.S. In particular. I always separated that from whatever my personal kind of spiritual beliefs might have been, which have varied over the years. One thing that I was thinking about, though, as you said that, and as I reflect on census plenier also, has to do with this question about experimentation, because I actually find that the Black church and the musical tradition within the Black church is a site of extraordinary experimentation and innovation. I remember that one of the most surprising things about working with the choir on this piece, you know, we came to them and we said, okay, we have this was a collaboration with an artist, Suhan Ho. So we came, she and I went to the choir director and we were like, guess what? First, we have this whole thing. Are you Sonetta's niece? Yes, I'm Sonetta's niece. Yes, I'm. and then we said, we want to do this thing. We've been thinking about the context of the Black Atlantic. We want to sort of borrow this really fraught text from Robinson Crusoe, in which he describes he's speaking kind of in the wake of this journey. This journey on a boat. We want to use this text, this reflection on the kind of psychological division that unfolds in this journey. We want to map that onto this song. This song is in your repertoire. We want to put one on the other. I know it's weird, but this is what we want to do. He's like, no problem. Mm-hmm. It's not that. It's not weird. I remember, because I was a student at the time, I came from a not traditional studio art background. I studied many different things. I studied literature. I worked in film. I was making music. I did all kinds of things, and I didn't really identify with fine art as a field. I never would call myself an artist. And I remember that working with the choir, they had this incredible faith in the vision of the work that I had never experienced for myself before. They had such deep trust. They said, you know, this experimentation is in the service of a vision, and that vision is yours, and we support it. That was a really powerful experience.
They also had capability.
And they're amazing.
That's the other thing that always impresses me about the church is that, I mean, people are working on their craft from the age of three collectively, and so that you have a group of people who are incredibly accomplished at what they do, which I think is the other part of not balking at experimentation.
Yep. No, that's so true. And in some ways, one of the challenges actually with the piece was to figure out how to how to engage but also destabilize a little bit the virtuosity of the choir, because they're so good. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, how can you use that while also making it a little off balance, by making some of those textural mappings a little bit awkward, by, you know, we asked the choir director to have this really active role the way that he does when he typically performs the song, by sort of prompting the halves of the choir, in order to have those, you know, these tiny little moments of, I don't know, these little moments of awkwardness that felt really important. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, similarly with Susan Webb, the central figure in Census Plenier, similarly, she's absolutely committed to this craft that she has developed to a kind of virtuosic degree. She is an unbelievable mover, and she's developed an incredibly rich sort of theory to contextualize the way that she thinks about what it means to move in a church, what it means to move for others, what it means to move others. It's a theory that has nothing to do with it has nothing to do with performance. It's really she's really profoundly committed to developing her own model and being in dialogue with others who are also participating in the same practice to articulate a model for thinking about movement. And that model can unfold with incredible virtuosity at any age. She came to this as an adult. Although she had always been connected to the church in different ways, and so that the rigor is so powerful and is something that that is so rewarding for so rewarding to be allowed to be in contact with, actually.
But because we were talking early, you also talked about her having relative ambivalence to other to similar methods of communicating or similar methods of expression.
Yeah.
And that's what I really liked about your introduction, which I really got stuck on, was this idea of space, of miscommunication, of the idea of that we may never know anybody and that we may never, ever genuinely communicate. And then we talked about how we actually may never... It also has to do with being comfortable with the fact that we're not really connected anyway, that we have these electrodes that keep bouncing, so you can take it that much farther if you don't have a breakdown. If you're really smart, you will have a breakdown. I have a girlfriend that have one because of that. But that idea of being comfortable with no resolution, and that in connection to when, you know, the Huey Newton quote, where he's talking about utopia, and that the revolution is actually the hope of getting to utopia, and that process of getting there.
Yeah. And the arrow of longing for another shore. Right. So beautiful.
Longing for another shore. And as soon as you got to those last two pieces, that's when I felt like I was on a boat towards utopia, and a utopia that kept moving further and further away. I could still see the shore, but it was going to keep, you know, just the way white people in America will constantly move the goalposts. You know, Black America has had this history of mastering every rule and every every guideline. We mastered it from the first generation that was brought over, and that was the game. You know, all, going from Frederick Douglass to to William Wells Brown, to you know, Du Bois, all along the line, you know, and then you get to Obama, and then this time they're like, okay, we're just going to burn the goalpost, because each time they just move the goalpost, just mm-hmm. change the rules a little bit.
Yeah.
lawyers will tell you that all the time. Black lawyers will use that example many, many times about how the goalpost, and it's a specific Black American, white American game, but it also happens here too. I've seen it happen here. But now we have Trump, which is just a result of burning down the goalpost entirely and saying, well, if you're going to play the game that well, we're just going to burn the playing field and it doesn't matter. Mm. But I just got distracted.
Don't think about Trump.
The 45th will distract you. But what I liked about this idea of space and trying to get comfortable with that, it made me then think about what you were doing with choirs. And first of all, you know, your work, one with Dirty Projectors, who are all about harmonies.
Yeah.
And all about getting people to sing together and to get multiple voices working in a certain way. And then how dissonant some of what you put together was, but then how you also you finished with a single voice. There's all these choirs in the beginning, and you can see you, I could see you negotiating and DJing and mashing up, because there's a lot of mashup going on, but each voice still having its edges, you know, each voice having its definitions, and then it fusing into that one solid voice, and then there's a bunch of other stuff, but I guess I just wanted to talk about that choir. And also, the screams.
Screams.
The screams, the mumbles, and the hollers. because, you know, there's a long history of people writing about that and about the power of the scream. The inaudible, you know, what is not words. You know? and I was just thinking, I was just reading a friend of mine who's been working on a book on Wu-Tang's 36 Chambers, which goes back to... James Brown's, of course, because the main sample on there is a James Brown sample, which is that scream that comes through in Superbad, you know, and the same scream that Public Enemy used, and how that and the evolution of that scream. And for me, that really resonated when you got to Smokey Robinson's Quiet Storm, which is not quiet at all.
Nope.
It's the most disturbing love song in so many ways. You know, it's someone's making love with a back scratcher. But so I was wondering just about all those different...
That's a lot, yeah. I guess maybe first I would say a few words about the scream. On the second page of this document here, I have this long quotation from Nathaniel Mackey's Base Cathedral, which is a novel that I recommend that all of you spend time with. I first came to the novel through, as I think many of Mackey's more recent supporters have come to him through the work of the theorist Fred Moten, who's written really beautifully about sound and particularly about the scream. His book In the Break, one could argue that it takes sort of radical black performance traditions as its subject. The book In the Break actually begins, and its central metaphor is. Metaphor might not even be quite the right word. I'm sensitive to the fact that this is being recorded, its kind of central figure is this articulated. He says the scream is the sound of the black object becoming a subject, or is the sound of an object becoming a subject. Mm-hmm. That the sound of an object becoming a subject sort of produces this moan. It produces this wordless thing, and that wordless moment is the kind of animating force of black performance. Is the reason that black performance is a kind of experimentation at the core of black performance and the kind of engine of it. This extended quotation from Nathaniel Mackey's novel describes the protagonist discussing the role of a kind of figure in singing, particularly falsetto, when a man sings just above, outside of their range, above their range, and that he suggests that this false voice is surprisingly close to a moan. It exists in some way. It has a kind of excessive relationship to language or to the kind of standard voice, and that falseness, but also that excessiveness is where the meaning is actually produced. He speaks particularly of Al Green and has this kind of devastating metaphor in which he compares all of that going on about love and suggests the falsetto is very in close proximity to being strangled, and says, you know, isn't there some relation between a falsetto and the specter of lynching? This is what he sort of conjures. I think a lot about the ways in which I think one of the reasons that I and many others, one of the many, many reasons that I find myself returning again and again to improvisation specifically as a kind of performative strategy, as a model, is that it enables us to think about the collision that is how kind of sound or music, or even we could even speak a little more abstractly and say something like a thought, like how it is filtered through the body, how the body and how the body resists it, and what that sounds like, what that feels like, how it's palpable. And for me, although my starting point is often thinking about language and resistance to language, obviously this is something that happens entirely sort of on the outside or through or at the edges or against what it is that language can do. Sometimes it's helpful for me to think about that friction between sound and language as the place where that's the problem of what language cannot accomplish is most available, most palpable. Mm-hmm. These are scattered thoughts in response to some of the different ideas that you're bringing up.
But what's interesting about what you're saying about language there is also there's this growing theory that humanity actually sang before we talked.
Yep.
And so that's actually where the dissonance might come from, this really a revisiting of what's a coup d'etat.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much effect, it's, you know, when words actually did come, it's like Gilgamesh taking away Inanna's power and then Zeus taking Gilgamesh and starting to birth people out of his head, which
yeah.
is just something men do not do.
But then also, and related to this theory that people may have, that humans may have sung before they spoke, there's a related theory that humans may have been contact call animals, like that they may have been actually singing all the time, singing to each other all the time, and that it was silence that was the kind of proof of death. It was silence that was the signal that something was wrong, but that actually we expect to always be listening to each other, and that this is why, for example, babies are always babbling out loud, because it's more similar to what to how human communicative faculties may have once lived in the world, in sort of constant contact. Yeah, and then in response to this other thing about sort of choirs versus individuals, I mean, of course, there's so much to say about that. I think, I think it would be fair to say that when I began working with Sidetrack, in some ways, it was their particular dynamic as a trio that served as a kind of muse that helped me clarify how what it is that I thought I could do in conversation with them. And so what you heard in the first excerpt, the same time excerpt, which is them kind of playing around. I actually showed them. I don't know how many of you have seen this video by John Baldessari, in which he sings these sentences on conceptual art by Saul LeWitt, but it's kind of silly. It's very serious because John Baldessari is very serious, but it's also kind of ridiculous. At the same time, there's a way. I mean, at the time, I was thinking a lot about how Baldessari often positioned himself or his friends, Ed Henderson, his various friends that are always named in the work, as these kind of neutral figures. And I was thinking about ways of sort of re-examining how those voices are always already inflected, and I was thinking about just the moment of the LeWitt's sentences, which function almost like a manifesto of a kind, and then how that interacts with Larry Neal's text. And so I invited them to do this thing that was kind of funny. But when we made the work after that, the same time work, they had a very specific task, which was that I asked them to sing in three-part harmony throughout, without otherwise communicating. I asked them not to talk. That work actually has a few different moments. We made it over quite a while, and there are different things, different parts where they do different things. But the part that you heard today is I asked them to continue to sing continuously, each of the three of them, and to work anything out that they had to work out through the singing.
But that's what you can hear, and I was kind of bummed that you edited, because it's not fair. There's some of these that I've heard prior, but then I stopped because I didn't think it would be fair if we were all together when there were certain things I hadn't heard. But I did cheat with that one. And, and the thing is, in that one, you could really feel the competition.
Yep.
In the same way with Lanique, with track two.
Yep.
Is that there's this deep competition that goes back to what you're talking about in terms of finding a way to be comfortable with the fact that we're never going to know each other, we're never going to be connected, that we're never going to reach the promised land. River Jordan is... Right. We're stuck in the middle of it.
Right.
And... And that also was incredibly poignant to me in the second one, which for me was one of the best articulations of at least my Black experience, with this constant, just the amount of how you can be irreverent and totally reverent at the exact same time. How I can burst out laughing and be simultaneously crying. And, you know, there's some very profound ways that's happened. I have a very good friend from college, Eddie, who grew up in Birmingham. And when he found himself in Massachusetts and he could finally relax, he started to laugh and literally relax because he used to get chased home. People trying to kill him because he was a gay kid growing up in Birmingham. White people trying to kill him. And he would just laugh because he couldn't cry. He had cried maybe once when he was four, and so he would just laugh. So that's one kind, and that's a tradition that we live with.
Yep.
But then there's also this what you're talking about, this finding, just living with our dissonance.
Yep.
And that reverence and irreverence together is my fuel as an artist, I think.
Yep.
But it's also very moving. Like, I found myself really choked up when I would hear them competing. That would get my attention. And then the way they would dismantle, disarm, deconstruct this stuff, and then insert these melodies that just were a part of my core.
Yeah.
You know, when all of a sudden he does inserts Lift Every Voice and Sing, I'm like, I want to punch him and hug him at the same time.
Lift Every Voice and Sing is called the Black National Anthem in the U.S. A song that it's the easiest way to like divide a room, a mixed room in America. Start singing that song. Every Black person knows that song. No white people know that. It just is like a thing that everyone knows. Everyone can sing it. I had to play it on clarinet. Yes, I really did.
I had some technical questions too, but you have a question.
Just to,
please.
I think that it's really useful, particularly when talking about the specificity and indeed the rootedness of these, let's say, kind of familial but at the same time abstract notions of Blackness, being Black as a political subject, also as an artist, and the implications being different in so many different contexts that one might want to, particularly in your work, Mike, that I understand and haven't done enough research on because I've been, you know,
okay.
But it seems to me that perhaps the kind of aims of not exactly the sphere of let's say making music commercially, but that's making it for an audience that has to be to some extent more broad than that entering into a space physically of art, because we always think of it as one that's maybe perhaps more culturally inscribed. I'm just wondering about the differences there, because I think Stephanie and I have had such broad conversations. One memorable one, in at least for me, was arguing the cultural relevance of Brandy as a kind of central figure in R&B music. And obviously, I think it's clear me bringing up which side I was on.
That we can
end with that debate, but I mean, it's at almost every level, and I think one of the kind of seamless things that listening session managed to do is kind of seam together that, say, the sphere of music as a kind of public knowledge, the music we all relate to, music from school dances or, you know, whatever that might be, and then music obviously embedded in Stephanie's practice, which is trying to do something entirely different. I'm not sure if it even wants to be listened to in the way that, say, jazz music as a whole has usually been constructed or conceived to be listened to. But the politics of that, you know, making music where your intended audience isn't necessarily a listening one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, those last two works, for those who didn't have time to read the essay that I included, those last two works were constructed using a pitch-based language, a language that's created from musical notes, that was invented by a 19th-century French composer named François Sude. And he imagined that this could serve as a universal second language for Europe. The language, what's interesting, one of the many things about the language that's interesting to me is that it sounds musical, but it's actually not music. It's language. It's text. And as language, it's almost impossible, even for those who have studied the material to decipher, for all kinds of structural reasons. It just doesn't work as something people can understand. The idea. One of the hardest things about working with Black music is, of course, that it's one of Black Americans' biggest global, most successful global exports culturally. Mm-hmm. It's widely consumed internationally, and it is often used as a shorthand to communicate any number of ideas, including the kind of experience of Black pain or Black jubilation, in the context of a gospel choir, for example. And so one of the challenges as I continue to think about the ways in which music is capable of functioning as a kind of model in my practice has been to find ways of using music that doesn't play into those expectations or those that isn't immediately legible according to those conventions, even as it might invite us to think in relation to those conventions. It can't be deciphered entirely that way. And so when the saxophone performance that was the second to last, that's just a documentation of a performance that I presented a few months ago in a mall. So you actually hear the alarm keeps going off in the boots. It was in England. And people kept coming up to us again and again. They kept coming up to us and saying, "Is this, you know, what is this? Is this jazz? Is this jazz? Is this jazz?" And finally we were like, "Yes, it's jazz." knowing that what they were about to hear was, you know, that, you
but
know,
that's
that,
exactly how the form happened.
Exactly.
I mean, that's how, you know.
Yeah. Yes. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. But then you're absolutely right. It's true. It is how the form happened. But then it also, I was just going to say that it's consistent with, but complicates these expectations that they have of what jazz is. On the one hand, it's jazz or jazzy in the sense that something that's made with paint is a painting. That we, you know, that there's some media that are impossible to separate from a form, from a set of critical traditions. At the same time, it doesn't participate in any of the musical logic or development of jazz. That's all.
And how would you quantify that in the second piece? I mean, because you're saying both of these pieces are written from that language.
Yeah.
And that was my other question. This is just a technical question. How did you create those?
Yeah. I found a French dictionary and English dictionary. I found like a few different dictionaries that were contemporaneous. And I took, in the case of the second piece, I took this text. My voice trembled so hard it sounded like singing is the quotation. And I literally translated the text into the language. In the first case, the performance actually had a kind of different structure. I started with this song "Quiet Storm," which you heard at the very beginning. The saxophonist deconstructed the song, and actually viewers who were interested had this score that showed what each of those words meant, and it's basically nonsense. Like, it just, you know, it translates into all of these little things that don't resolve into anything at all. He moved through that in all of these different permutations, and then began to move almost seamlessly into a translation of the song, a translation of the song into the language. You wouldn't even be able to tell the difference because it's so atomized.
So he goes from improvising to actually falling into the groove of the thing.
He goes from improvising into playing the score that is like the formal translation of the thing. Yeah.
And you're saying that he wouldn't have been able to arrive at that point without improvising?
The first half of the piece that, like, the portion that we heard, was deeply rooted in his improvisation, even as all of the potential translations of those improvisations were also offered to viewers who were interested. But there, it was more interesting sort of conceptually that you're aware of those possibilities. Yeah. Just the idea that it's legible musically and anti-musically. Yeah.
I wonder if you would talk a bit more about the obviously important role that collaboration plays in this work, and not just the obviously important collaboration with other performers or other musicians or composers, but in the Promise Machine piece, I was especially interested in how it arises out of this process where you began the reading group and then you're interacting with other visual arts. So there's actually this idea of a collaboration maybe between media. It seems like a quite complex and important thing for your work.
That is a good question. That's also something Mike and I were talking about a little bit earlier. You know, I'm not, I mean, there are things I could say, but to be honest, I would say that there are aspects of collaborating or of working with other artists that always produce problems. They produce different problems every time, and it's the fact that they produce problems reliably, even though those problems are always different, that makes it so enduringly useful for me. Mm-hmm. It's not the only way that I work, but it's a really important way for me to work. It's a way for me to test ideas, and it's a way for the ideas to. You know, I have a really complicated relationship to the way that authorship and ownership function in an art context. It's a way to complicate some of those relations. It's a way to distribute, to disperse the experience of the work across multiple performers. It does a lot of different things for me. Last year, I was a visiting artist at a school that has a really interesting model where for every visiting artist, the students provide a kind of conference on the artist's work for the artist in their presence. And so all of these, I arrive and I do studio visits and meet with the students, and then the students have been studying me. And so they gave all these talks about my work. And one of them gave a really beautiful talk about the concept of the fugue, and suggested that there was some aspect of my practice that was sort of similar to the way that a fugue is seeded with a melody that's then kind of permutates across multiple generations. That really resonated with me as a description. It's a very good question. Thank you.
But just a follow up: Have every collaboration you've done been coming from a concept that you came up with, and how is it different when you're leading the collaboration and when you're just a participant?
Yeah, not necessarily in the sense that however, I would say that I am more eager to collaborate than most people I know, and so it is very often that I'm the one who's like, let's work together in some way or another. I mean, the word collaborate also is kind of complicated because sometimes you're really sharing, you're creating something together. Other times you're working together in ways that are more strategic, as you also know. For example, I did an exhibition with Jamal Cyrus at the New Museum in 2011 called Alpha's Bed Is Not Over Yet, and that exhibition I would say was jointly initiated by me and Jamal. We developed the ideas together. We developed the installation together. We each brought very different things to the work as it unfolded. Sometimes collaborations have different lives. With that particular piece, I would say that in its initial moment, it was very much shared in every way, and really, it came out of a reading group that I would say that he was really the seed for, in the sense that he contacted me saying, I think we should have a reading group to discuss More Brilliant Than the Sun, mm-hmm. by Ko Jua Shun, and from that we decided to assemble a kind of small group of artists and activists to kind of work through these several readings together, and it was through those readings that we decided to have this that the exhibition sort of evolved.
And you both stayed on a similar same plane.
Well, no, I was going to say that we absolutely did until after the exhibition was over. Ooh. After the exhibition was over, not in a bad way, just not in a bad way at all. But after the exhibition was over, you know, we each had different areas of interest related to the show, and so we continued with different aspects of it, and which is also really great. Like, there is a way in which you're kind of like coming together. You know, your fellow travel, you're coming together, and then you can step apart. And I would say this a similar thing is the case with Microcosmos. It really, my collaboration with Justin Hicks is incredibly important. It's a central part of my practice right now, and it's something that we really initiated, that we both initiated. It felt like necessary.
This is what I wanted to say is that, I mean, you're focusing on music, which is 99% inherently collaborative.
Yep.
That you really can't avoid it.
Yep.
And it's funny because we always do talk about collaboration as this very intentional thing, in the same way we talk about improvisation as a very intentional thing that takes a lot of process and discipline. But then you think about pop bands. You know, when we go and I bring up boy bands intentionally, because of just the inherent amount of collaboration it takes, and then also just, it's not just a collaboration of the artists. These things are built by committee.
Exactly.
You know, and people's careers are on the line. You know, kids aren't going to get into private school if this singer doesn't deliver it in this way. You know, I love. And you were doing this earlier, being able to juxtapose your position. We were talking about having these very small audiences and what that means, but also juxtapose the type of rigor that we do in relationship to these pop machines or whatever it is. You know, it could be film, but we were talking about music in particular.
And I have a film background also, I should mention. And so I went to film school before I went to art school, and I think that that model, that where the work is sort of inevitably always already a collaboration, is in the DNA of how I think about what it means to be an artist. So it's actually more of an effort to go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's more of an effort to be alone.
Yeah.
To do it all by yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because I used to only work alone. Like, my first two records I made all by myself, which I could do because I was making records in 1996. So the technology was available that I could create everything, even if I didn't actually play an instrument.
Yep.
And I could put it all together, and I made the first three records I made like that, completely by myself.
Yep.
And now, especially since living here, just because of economic necessity, I work with people all the time because I need to be in about four or five different bands just to feed my children. And and so I had no choice but to vigorously collaborate.
Yep.
And now I'm at a point where I'm completely at a loss when I work alone.
Mm.
I really don't know what to do with myself.
Yeah.
And it's so that I think there is an equilibrium somewhere.
Yeah, totally.
But that's why I want to talk to you about the project.
Mike is hatching up a collaboration.
Yes, I am. I'm publicly hatching a collaboration.
Yeah. Does anybody else have any questions?
Well, how about we wrap it up and then we have a drink and some food. Thank you very much, Stephanie, Mike, and